Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Ethel Quinn, who is a senior lecturer in American Studies at the University of Manchester, about her new book, A Piece of the Action, Race and Labour in Post-Civil Rights Hollywood. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you. It's good to be here.
This is a fascinating book that speaks directly to a whole load of contemporary issues in film studies, media studies, cultural production, but also obviously is grounded in a very important and specific historical analysis as well. And I'm interested to set the scene as to what got you interested in writing about this period in Hollywood and maybe writing about film and race in general.
Well, I'd written a book on gangster rap. From that book, looking at the 1980s and 90s and the emergence of gangster rap in Los Angeles and in the American South, and taking a kind of production-oriented approach, but that also looked a lot at textual analysis and reception, I realized that a kind of precursor, a very powerful precursor for gangster rap was 1960s and 1970s culture, and particular black action films, blaxploitation films, Sweetback, Superfly, The Mac. These were films that were sampled in gangster rap, and also the kind of ghetto archetypes, quite masculinist ghetto archetypes that were absolutely at the core of gangster rap. These fictionalized macho archetypes really drew on this earlier period. So that's, I guess, how I landed on late 1960s and 1970s film culture, because that was the moment when these archetypes actually that go much further back into African-American folkloric history and oral culture, the bad man, the pimp, the kind of dissident masculinity that we see in novels previously, they first made their way onto film screens in the early 1970s. So that's how I got in. I first wrote a piece on The Mac quite a while ago, because that's very powerful as a kind of generative text for. It's about pimp culture in the Bay Area, San Francisco, and Oakland. And from there I got to Superfly, and I looked at the kind of entrepreneurial creative, or what I'm calling in this new book, the hustler creative, as a kind of key archetype within film culture back in the 1970s and even in the late 1960s.
It's probably worth clearing the ground a bit, talking about the period, and you call the period the transitional years. And I guess, as well as sort of getting to grips with why that period matters, we need to know a bit about what was going on in Hollywood before this. So can you kind of sketch out the transitional period and maybe say a bit about what exactly those years are transitioning from and to?
Yeah, so the transitional years really comes from race sociologists and historians who look at that moment following the end of formal white supremacism in America. I mean, it's shocking that really until the mid-1960s and those civil rights victories, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, that America was a white supremacist state. It was enshrined in law that was a kind of form of racial apartheid. So it really, in the mid-1960s, this momentous moment when these legislative victories happen in the civil rights movement, also a moment of burgeoning Black politicization, Black power, Black consciousness. And so that's really where, I mean, I start with that kind of sociological and race historiography sort of lens. And I slice into Hollywood from that angle. So it's kind of an interdisciplinary book. Really, I mean, the ending of formal segregation, the ending of Jim Crow, formal Jim Crow, of course, it didn't really end. And we can see now with the current election, all the kind of voter suppression. And of course, we get the new Jim Crow later. So I'm not saying that all was over with these civil rights victories in the mid-1960s, by no means. But what happens when these formal victories occur is that the battle then commences to try and operationalize the new laws to make workplaces fair, to make educational settings, to open up education and to enfranchise Black people and so forth. That was the beginning of actually making these new laws real for, you know, on the ground. So to turning the kind of formal changes in the laws into de facto change. And so what happens in Hollywood then is I think extraordinarily important, because Hollywood was a hugely exclusionary racist space. It didn't necessarily think of itself in those terms. It often tried to project an image of liberalism, of you know, those kind of PR messaging that it was a space of pluralism or integration. But actually, Hollywood is, in terms of as a workplace, was the head of the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission boss, said, you know, it was a venal space. It was actually worse than other industries, even other cultural industries, when they went to look. So Black and brown people were really only doing jobs as messengers and janitors. There'd never been an African-American film director of a Hollywood film. And, you know, even after the, you know, until the end of the 60s. So that was this transitional moment was the moment when we were transitioning from Jim Crow racism into something new. And so it was a time of massive contestation over race in America.
And we can see this in terms of representation as well. You mentioned quite early on in the book, Gone with the Wind, which obviously is full of, I guess, what we call, you know, just explicitly racist stereotypes, and yet incredibly popular, something that was kind of held up as being a truly great kind of Hollywood film. And I guess this is an example of the sort of representations we get pre-transitional years.
Right. So Gone with the Wind is an arch racist text. It glorifies slavery post-slavery moment. It romanticizes this idea of a kind of plantation society in the most extreme sort of racist ways, and that's been established by film historians. I mean, there's lots of great work on how terrible that text is. Released in 1939, pre-transition, of course. But what I wanted to show in the book was what a live text Gone with the Wind still was in the 1960s and 1970s, in the transitional period. In fact, what a live text it is today. We've recently had this kind of culture war issue around when HBO Max wanted to suspend Gone with the Wind from its streaming after the movement for Black Lives emerged this year, and this reckoning with America's racist history, and the massive outcry that came. White Americans are absolutely invested in Gone with the Wind for racist reasons, for a nostalgia for a kind of racially apartheid period. And this is certainly true in the 1960s and 1970s. So Gone with the Wind kept getting re-released after its first release in 1939. When it first was released in 1939, it was the longest film that had ever been released. It was a high prestige text. You know, America was very, the Hollywood industry was very proud of Gone with the Wind. And then they made loads of money across those post-war years. So that when in 1967, it was re-released in the cinemas, in the theatrical release in America, it was the second highest grossing film of the year in 1967. So that's the dawning of the Hollywood Renaissance and all kinds of new, more experimental, innovative kinds of films that were being produced. That's what we think of in 1967. We think of change and social unrest, radicalization, politico-aesthetic experimentation that even travels into cinema. But actually, the second highest grossing film of the year is the re-release of Gone with the Wind. And then in the 1970s, the late 70s, when Gone with the Wind gets its television release, it breaks records. When you see the public opinion about America's favorite film, it's the number one favorite film that carries on into the 80s and 90s. It's the number one favorite film in America. Now, it's not the favorite film of Black Americans, and therefore white people massively mobilize around this film text, and it's an arch racist film text. So yeah, I mean, we know the history of Gone with the Wind and how, you know, shockingly racist it was in 1939. And that period, actually, of film history and race is very, very well served. But I think we have to really understand how it continued to have extraordinary traction symbolically for white people in those post-war transitional years and beyond.
I guess a sort of... slightly uncritical or, you know, slightly unreflective history of Hollywood would then say something like, oh, but look at In the Heat of the Night as, you know, a sort of an important film in terms of changing representations of race, of, you know, offering a kind of critical perspective on white supremacy. And indeed, in the book, you use In the Heat of the Night as an important case study, but also you try and say, actually, it's a bit of a problem. In terms of its impact on equality, both kind of, you know, as a film, but also in terms of its production and the kind of broader political economy of Hollywood.
Right. Yeah. So In the Heat of the Night, it's a kind of provocative text to focus on, but I do focus extensively on this one film to try and really sort of showcase the kind of model that I'm using in the book, and also because I think it just is a very, very important text for that transitional moment when that racial contestation, that intense debate was happening and battle over resources was happening in America. So it comes out in 1967, and it was a much loved text. For Black people and for white people. Americans loved this text, and it was very critically acclaimed. You know, it wins best picture at the Oscars. And I tried to explain why it was so loved, and, you know, I'm trying to produce a complex reading. But what I really want to get at is how, yeah, so on the one hand, it's the film which allows Sidney Poitier to become the most bankable star of the year in 1968, along with his two other releases, To Sow With Love and Guess He's Coming to Dinner, the highest box office film. But the most critically acclaimed of his three films in 1967, which allowed him to become the most bankable star in 1968, was In the Heat of the Night. That was the one that had the kind of racial credibility that really credentialized Hollywood as a liberal reformist space. So it did a lot of important, public relations work for the industry. So I wanted to really look at that, and both to sort of honor that, the fact that Sidney Poitier, you know, that was an extraordinary feat that he became the most bankable star. And so it did showcase certain kinds of new kinds of white tolerance in America that captures the transitional years and which really, points forward to kind of post-racial dynamics afterwards. Although, you know, we have to bear in mind that the next person to be the most bankable, next non-white person to be the most bankable star in Hollywood is Will Smith in The Noughties. So it is an extraordinary and aberrational outlying moment, Sidney Poitier being the most bankable star. But I do want to pause on that, and that was incredibly powerful for Black people. And it was also, you know, a certain kind of, represented a certain kind of racial tolerance amongst whites. But the film, is actually quite an accommodationist text. Some historians have already pointed that out. So it maps a story where he is in a Mississippi small town and there's a murder, and he gets together with the local white sheriff, Rod Steiger, and together they solve the crime. And he's a kind of racial exception in an all-white space. He sort of helps white people, and there's no sense of kind of black community. He's this individualist, extraordinarily professionalized black person. And so it's very Hollywoodized and so forth. Now, what I really wanted to show, and what I think was new about my kind of approach, was that I wanted to show how that film, because I take this kind of looking at production and text together, I look at production and representation, was how Poitier represented a character who is fictionally Tibbs is a detective in Philadelphia who's the number one homicide detective in Philadelphia, and he's earning a huge salary, much more than the Southern sheriff. So the film represents this idea of the North as already being integrated, already having resolved its race problem, and to have moved into a kind of post-racial space. And that's the premise of the film. Now, then it likes to show a kind of benighted South where things need to change. But what I wanted to show was how actually this reflexively then presented a picture of Hollywood as being part of the North and West, which was enlightened, which likes to sort of show, oh yes, in the South they've got problems, but actually presented a picture of the film industry, and the film was used as PR work. The MPAA boss liked to showcase this film and go on road trips with it to show what Hollywood can do. And actually that that really captures a kind of post-racial obfuscation or denial of the fact that actually in Hollywood they're not yet been a single black director of a Hollywood film. So we've got an incredibly racially exclusionary space in Hollywood, and lots of forces are about to try and mount this attempt to integrate Hollywood, to bring racial justice to Hollywood. And Hollywood is presenting this fiction, which is that Northern workplaces are already fully integrated. So there's a real kind of quiescence. There's a real denial that goes on. So I see the film and I read the film as a kind of proto post-racial text, which is actually very pro-white. It's kind of suggesting that there's no need for intrusive integration efforts because we're already in the North and the West and in Hollywood through the screen representation, we've already arrived. And actually then I show that actually behind the scenes it's an all-white production. It captures the fact that behind the scenes, it's white people making money off the film. It's white people producing the film. The white director, Jewison, is quite a retreatist, quite a reactionary figure, actually. He's kind of a liberal in racial retreat. The film is reflexively helping Hollywood not to, to kind of rebuff integration efforts.
There are like loads more things to pick up on that point, actually, because you show in the middle section of the book both how opportunities were essentially kind of hoarded in terms of key films and key directors, but also how there was essentially a neoconservative reaction against the affirmative action moment, and just as in the heat of the night at the end of the 60s is supposed, as you say, to be a symbol of the kind of changing or progressive or even settled new Hollywood. Actually, what's going on is both, a lack of opportunity and also a quite aggressive neoconservative reaction to stop affirmative action.
Yeah. So, picking up on then the response, I mean, I guess there's two bits there. So first of all, following this in this transitional moment and following this, the legislative victories and with the strength of black mobilization and black power at that time, the federal government does this probe in Hollywood, sees that it's much more white even than television and then other industries in California and elsewhere, and really wants to, it brings in the Justice Department really to to bring lawsuits against the studios and the unions. It's an extraordinary moment. This is 1970 now. 69, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, go into Hollywood, see how bad things are. And then they call in the Justice Department. So between 1970 and 1972, we get this moment where Hollywood management and unions are facing off against the Justice Department. The Justice Department want to bring in, they want to bring in targets. It's, you know, they wanted to bring in quotas for a brief period to actually make Hollywood change or face lawsuits. That got watered down to targets, but then those targets were introduced. But the response from Hollywood, from this kind of, supposedly intrusive government initiative, this federal project to action the legislative victories of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, were powerfully repudiated in Hollywood. And this is absolutely at the center of my book, looking institutionally at the organizations of management and labor and how they fought off the Justice Department and the Equal Opportunities Commission. And they did it in two main ways. They did it through PR, through film text, like In the Heat of the Night, showing Hollywood to be a liberal space, and by, you know, co-opting particular civil rights leaders to say good things about Hollywood. You know, and again, my approach looking at production and text shows that how you can, you know, you can use Hollywood stories to paint a picture which then masks what's going on behind the scenes. I think that's a key dynamic. So that's something that Hollywood can do very powerfully to avoid change and to stop change. So it remains an incredibly white space, but has these kind of key figures, whether it's Sidney Poitier or others, who can be showcased, I guess, are visible on screen. And of course, these are still dynamics that are with us today. So Hollywood did it through, and I'm thinking particularly of this guy, Jack Valenti, who's the head of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, incredibly deft PR person, messaging about Hollywood being a benign racial space. And that worked very powerfully. And also really hard-nosed lobbying of politicians. And so particularly Jack Valenti, but the Hollywood industry, what my book shows and what is not a story that's actually been told before, is that Hollywood really was behind the sacking of the head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Clifford Alexander. He was forced to step down. So that affected not just Hollywood, but integration efforts more generally in workspaces. So Hollywood has an inordinate power, not just through its symbolic representation and how that can reproduce social norms or potentially disrupt social norms through storytelling, which, you know, feeds into our sense of what's, you know, social norms, you know, any point in history, that kind of idea of Hollywood's power, but also actually hard-nosed power of the industry to influence politicians to speak. Valenti spoke directly to the leader of, very powerful leader of the Senate, Everett Dirksen, who then helped to sack the head of the EEOC. So it's a kind of hard behind the kind of facade of these pictures is hard-nosed politicking, and Hollywood does both.
If that's one half of the story, I guess the kind of unreconstructed Hollywood machine and its resistance to change. You've also got another, and this isn't the right language, but, you know, a much more kind of positive story of resistance and change in the industry through the efforts of filmmakers themselves. And in keeping with the book's bringing together of representation and production in the analysis, it'd be good to talk through some examples of resistance and change, probably through talking about films. So, you know, something like Superfly, which obviously is pretty famous still today. Sweetback's Badass Song, which again, you know, has left an important legacy. These are examples of how both representations are challenged and changing, but also actually how lines of funding change and about how the production system changes.
Sure, yeah. So that's right. So Stuart Hall always said, you know, we should avoid those sort of purely pessimistic accounts where, you know, the system always wins. You know, that's not how power is negotiated in the cultural realm and in the cultural industries, even when they're very, you know, capitalistic. That, you know, so that's the negotiation model. So even if we, if it's, you know, often the overriding narrative, and I think the overriding narrative of my book is one of, you know, pro-white consolidation, a kind of new kind of legitimation of white privilege and denial. You know, that's what I've just been talking about, I guess, is the super story. But actually, the picture is complex. I really did want to capture in the book the complexity of actually what was an extraordinary period, the 1960s and 1970s, and an inspirational period for today, because there was a lot of openness, which, you know, thereafter things closed, after the transition, things closed down into our sort of neoliberal, neoconservative order. And it seemed like there was a lot less, well, there was a lot less political space, there was a lot less radical space for a long time. We could say today, actually, that things are, in terms of Hollywood, there's a new kind of Black Renaissance maybe happening. You know, it's delicate, but it's, you know, there's a lot of Black filmmaking, Black film culture energy right now in Hollywood. And I think that really, you know, the model for that, the blueprint is the late 1960s and 1970s. So it's not simply that I want to show a more hopeful narrative along, you know, to offset just the pessimism. It actually, I think we have to show both sides if we want to capture this extraordinary period of ferment, which and of possibility, also political possibility, which was the late 1960s and 1970s, which I think we can learn from today. So yeah, as Jack Valenti and et al. were closing down space in Hollywood and re-articulating white dominance in Hollywood in that period, there actually was, you know, quite an extraordinary Black film wave. Quite, you know, there were a lot of Black film productions were finally made suddenly after there not being a single Black director, as I was saying, of a Hollywood film. There were quite a number in the early 70s. And, you know, this has to do with lots of reasons, the Black power, civil rights, also the changing tax regime in Hollywood that allowed for a lot more independent films to be made. It's a time of crisis and reconfiguration in Hollywood, and that opens spaces for different kinds of productions. There are a lot of different reasons we can map. And in that space, and this is, it's changed a bit, but there's still a tendency to see this as the Blaxploitation period, the Blaxploitation era, and to fall back on quite sort of kind of stereotypical tropes about what, you know, about what Black film represented in that moment. And actually, when you really look into what's happening in terms of Black themed films and Black produced films, there's actually a host of different kinds of films being made. Actually, some of the Blacks, what I call Blaxploitation films, are politically, have quite radical energies in them, and, you know, have cultural value, artistic value. So, you know, I'm not into, you know, these labels as being, you know, reductive, but actually there's a lot going on outside of Black exploitation pictures as well, a lot. And that's, I think, a story that's been undertold. So that's another story that I want to present in this book. Just to flag two things then. The first one is, you know, Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee emerge as stars of my story. They work with radical producer Hannah Weinstein and Cliff Frazier, who's a kind of labor activist, community activist in New York, to found the Third World Cinema. That's an interracial production company and training company in cinema, which has lots of stars associated with it. Sidney Lumet, lots of white leftists in Hollywood, along with lots of African American stars and playwrights, and actually a lot of people have been blacklisted in with McCarthy come towards something like Third World by the early 1970s, and they train up a lot of Black and Puerto Rican. It's based in New York, so particularly Puerto Rican, but also poor white trainees in film to bring them into as technicians into the film industry, and they get grants from government, both state government and federal government. And they produce films, and the idea is you produce films, and they produce Claudine, which was a success, Hollywood film, which then allows you to plow money back into the, so it's a kind of state funded, but also brings in money through film production. So that's quite an ambitious model for shifting the film industry that, you know, captures a lot of what you were talking about in your new book, Dave. But I think it's, you know, looking into that one, Sidney Poitier was doing something somewhat similar, but in, kind of less ambitiously. Harry Belafonte, another star, he was also training up and using government resources, Ford Foundation grants to try and integrate unions. So there's a lot of really, you know, drawing on the kind of politicization of the period, there are a lot of ambitious initiatives going on. Now, just to go then to return finally then to what you were asking about, which is things like then Superfly or Sweetback. I mean, the way I map it is really a turn from, you know, there's a moment, there's an optimistic moment, I think, represented by the likes of Third World Cinema or Harry Belafonte's initiative with the unions and the Ford Foundation, of thinking that that there can be top-down change, you know, that we need to really double down on these integration efforts that are coming from the federal government, and we need to really try and integrate the industry using the institutions, trying to reform the institutions. And that was very important work. But actually, as the 1970s came in, and as you were saying, the neoconservatives increasingly got a handle on how to repudiate the racial justice movement, the response, I think, from Black filmmakers was, actually, we need to do for ourselves. We need to, it was a kind of turn towards self-determination, increasing cynicism about the possibilities of post-civil rights reform in anything but just name. So this is a turn towards, more, this is the hustler creative that I was talking about earlier. And yeah, the likes of, Melvin Van Peebles represents this more than anybody. Melvin Van Peebles was the second ever studio director in Hollywood and with Watermelon Man. And he had a three-picture deal with Columbia, and he actually walked away from it because they didn't like the kind of content and the production crew he wanted to use on his second picture. He wanted to really radically integrate the production crew, and the unions wouldn't allow that. So the studio, you know, he couldn't really work through the studio for reasons of content and also labor. So he just walked away from his three-picture deal, even though he was only the second ever Black director. And then he made Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, 1971, which was a smash hit. And really, so powerfully represented how Black creatives could really do for self, could really, use incredible performative capital and entrepreneurial and networked radical sort of energies to make something outside of the Hollywood system. So that was a very, very powerful moment.
What's going on with gender relations in this period, both in terms of thinking about where we started this conversation about, I guess, the kind of now cliched tropes of Black masculinity in the form of, you know, the hustler, the pimp that comes from this this period, and, you know, the kind of, again, cliches of Blaxploitation films, but also in terms of women's role in this moment of Hollywood.
As you say, the 1970s, it wasn't just in Black film culture that there was a lot of misogyny, sexism, masculinism and so forth. It was much more broadly. I think we can think of, you know, Molly Haskell's From Reverence to Rape, or those kind of classic texts that just map how grimly misogynist the early 1970s was. You know, this moment of, I guess, Hollywood Renaissance flowering of, you know, these productions that are all by white men. But the flip side of that is, you know, is a very, very misogynist period. And that is reflected, that travels into Black film culture of the period to a degree. Certainly, there were next to no women working as directors. That's why I think it's important to think of Hannah Weinstein working, heading up the Third World Cinema Corporation. There's a radical space and look, it's headed by a female producer. But in the Black film wave, there are no female directors, but actually that's consistent with Hollywood in general, where there's next to no female Hollywood directors either, or you know, of non-Black film. So in the production side, which I want to look at throughout this book, there's very little going on for women. Textually, representationally, there's actually a surprising amount going on, because alongside the, you know, the sexism of blaxploitation that you've just referenced, there are actually a lot of new black heroines on cinema screens that have really never been seen before. And, you know, two that I look at in particular in my book, one is, you know, is Pam Grier, the emergence in the early 1970s of Pam Grier through black exploitation films like Foxy Brown and Coffee. Coffee was the first one, the one I look at in the most detail. And she's really the first, that for a week, Coffee was the highest grossing film in America. So, that film made a lot of money. A lot of people watched it. And she was actually the first action babe. Action babe cinema is something, you know, that really has taken off in the post-civil rights period. But she was the first action babe. She was like a, you know, also like the archetype of the final girl, you know, that we think of. But, you know, as I argue, you know, she's actually a sexualized final girl. So she manages to use whatever is to hand to you know, it's kind of vigilante style film to fight against these really grossly misogynist men, you know, malfeasant men in her life, you know, who are abusing her. And she uses whatever's to hand, you know, whatever resources, that's the kind of final girl element. And she wins out in the end, but she's done so as a sexualized woman rather than as, you know, I guess the final girl later, if we think of things like Halloween, you know, the idea is that if you, you know, were chased, then, you end up on top, but all the sexualized women end up dying, so they're kind of punished. But so Pam Grier actually is this action babe, the sexualized action babe, and that's a really interesting early archetype, and it's particularly for a black woman. So I think things like Coffee and Foxy Brown, complex, problematic gender politics for sure, but very interesting texts. And she did emerge as one of the key female stars of the 1970s, along with people like Barbara Streisand, Jane Fonda. Pam Grier was probably the third most important female star for a few years there in the 1970s. And the other one I just point to quickly is going back to Claudine, which was the biggest release of Third World Cinema. And Claudine is played by Deanne Carroll, she's actually a working class single mother of six children who have different fathers. So and it's a comedy. So, you know, this is a couple of years before Reagan coins this terrible racist trope that the welfare queen and all that, you know, neoconservative doubling down on, you know, on racist wedge issues of the 1980s and so forth. So just before Reagan takes office and starts coining, he first uses the term welfare queen in 1978. But here's a film in the mid 1970s in which, you know, it's about a single mother heroine and a romance and about her children and about, it's a melodrama and a comedy. So I think there's actually quite a lot of space. They're just two representative texts I pick on, but there's actually quite a lot of space, more than is recognized, for black female representation in the 1970s cinema.
How does the period end, both in terms of the changes in Hollywood and the kind of decline of the studio-made black film, but also in terms of how, counter-revolution of particular kinds of white immigrants' representations, flourish and really, really triumph by the time we're getting into the mid to late 70s?
Yeah, well, it ends abruptly. Well, I mean, I guess there's these mounting forces of reaction. So it's not abrupt in the story I tell, but actually in terms of the number of black productions, black themed films and black directed films, it kind of really falls off a cliff in the mid 1970s. That's partly, there's multiple determinants of that. This is the moment of the Hollywood, the new Hollywood consensus. Hollywood's been losing money, has been in crisis. Some studios have folded, some studios have almost folded. So by the mid-1970s, this consolidation means that by the late 70s, about half the number of productions were made as had been made in the early 1970s. So there's a move towards consolidation, blockbuster productions. It's really fueled by the changes to the tax law that make films a lot more risky to make, because you couldn't write off debt and so forth, through tax. So so there's suddenly there's a move away from black productions. And you know, I look at Rocky in 1976, just on that point of white ethnic revival that you were just talking about. There's already good scholarship on the symbolic importance of films like Rocky. Rocky was the runaway hit of 1976. You know, Rocky Balboa, Sylvester Stallone beats the champ, the black champ, the privileged and pampered black champ. And Rocky is the underdog, the white ethnic underdog, the Italian stallion, who somehow manages to, I mean, even if in the final fight, you know, there's, you know, it's stolen by the, I guess, the black champ or whatever, but very much the moral economy of the film is that Rocky ends out on top and sort of wins through. Now that story's been really well told already as a kind of iconic text of the white ethnic revival. It's absolutely there in Hollywood, and that's something I map behind the scenes and institutionally in the industry, white ethnic revival. But with Rocky, again, because I like to look at production and text together and see how they interrelate, what I was particularly interested in showing was that that Sylvester Stallone, who plays Rocky, he's also the scripter. It's his story idea, and he's the scripter for the film. And so he is a kind of underdog that comes into the industry, the kind of plucky white underdog, besting the privileged and pampered elite that's a kind of black privilege, black masculine privilege. And so that had enormous power, I think, for a lot of white people. I mean, the story on screen of Rocky besting the champ, but also as a kind of Hollywood story of, you know, of kind of the true meritocracy of Hollywood, in which, you know, a white outsider, a white maverick like Sylvester Stallone can break into the industry and tell his story and have the runaway hit of the year. And you know, it's such a terrible story, really, because, you know, it's such an apocryphal story, because it really rests on the idea that black people have somehow are over entitled, that suddenly they are the elite, that they're the ones who have the unfair privilege. This is neoconservatism. This is the neoconservative reaction, that actually America is already a meritocracy, and so suddenly black people have been elevated through civil rights and black power and so forth, and are a new kind of elite that then need to be you know, righteously toppled by aggrieved white men who never really enjoyed white privilege. So that's where the white ethnic, you know, Rocky is Italian. This is the culture wars right here. And a character like Rocky and then Sylvester Stallone as an industry force really represent that backlash politics, that aggrieved whiteness, which targets blackness as an entitled space, when of course black people at that point were nowhere in the industry, and they were nowhere funding anything. You know, they had no partners really. So this is the backlash politics, the culture wars that really, I think, is a very powerful story that we still have today with Trumpism.
Yeah, I mean, the book, as well as being a historical analysis, is absolutely essential reading to understand the contemporary cultural production, contemporary film, and contemporary issues of inequality. And on that point, I just wonder, where do you sort of go next in your own analysis? Are you thinking about further work on this subject in this space, or are you going to be working on something completely different?
I would love to do more work on this. I've got a lot more, you know, I really feel that the contemporary period in Hollywood, very much, the late 60s, early 70s was a kind of blueprint and set a lot of the trends which we've, you know, in complex ways, you know, over time, you know, it's come back around right now, you know, with films like Get Out. I mean, I guess in my conclusion, I do offer quite a detailed picture of some of the trends as I see them today in Hollywood. And, you know, what, if anything, the story of the late 60s and early 70s was that a kind of robust attempt at affirmative action, at fairness, at equity was rebutted. It was powerfully and fundamentally rejected by the white majority. And that has held true. And so this move towards the kind of hustler creative or you know, self-determination is, of Melvin Van Peebles as represented in films like Superfly and other films. That really is the way that's been the kind of roadmap in contemporary Hollywood, I think, for a new kind of black filmmaking culture to emerge. If we think of Spike Lee, he starred in the films and was able then from there to sort of create himself as a kind of auteur star that then could get the funding behind the scenes, script his own films. So that's obviously the classic black self-determination story in the post-civil rights period. And it really captures, you can't wait for whites in the industry to do the right thing. So, he self-starts and, as Mookie at the end of Do the Right Thing, his classic text, he gets paid. He gets paid by the white pizzeria owner, picks up the money. And of course he did with that film. And that's a story of self-determination. And we get similar stories where what I show in the conclusion really is that the kind of performative power, the kind of virtuosic performance, really, I guess, of African Americans in particular, can be used then as leverage to open up a very exclusionary white industry. So you start as a star, you establish yourself first as a performer. If we think of Jordan Peele and Get Out, he's a comedian. You start first as a performer, and from there, then you become. You can then get the funding and open up, use that as leverage to try and, because of course these the very sophisticated black film workers know, and black film performers know, just as they did as Poitier did, that unless you actually hold the purse strings or unless you can put the package together, then you really are disempowered. It really narrows what's possible to do on screen. So there's a real shift of creatives from performers and then into production, and that's really a story of self-determination that Black Americans in particular have been able to develop very, very influentially, and that's a positive story to end on.